Hello and welcome to another episode of the Men with the Golden Tongues. I am your host, Micah, joined by my co-host, Brad.
Metal Gear 3?
That's right. We're here to talk about Metal Gear Solid 3, Snake Eater. This game came out November 17th, 2004.
It was 2004?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. At least that's what Wikipedia is telling me.
Golly. I thought it was 2005. Like, I thought, I wasn't that old.
I guess. Yeah, no, you are. You are incredibly old. And look, I will admit, right off the bat, I never finished this Metal Gear Solid. I didn't finish this game. Mm-hmm. And it's on my pile of shame. And for a very long time, I didn't know I hadn't finished the story. Which is really sad because I really enjoy this story. I watched all the cutscenes before we did this, and I actually really like this story. I like it. It's easy and simple to follow. Mm-hmm. And I am a simple person. A simple to follow story from Hideo Kojima is a marvel in and of itself. But yeah, I dig this. I can see this being my favorite Metal Gear story. Mm-hmm. It also helps that it is overtly trying to be like a spy movie from the 60s, mm-hmm. right? Complete with pre-credit sequence, a black woman singing bombastically about nonsense during the credits. And it's got this 60s vibe that evokes classic James Bond tales. I had a good time rewatching this, and they're remaking this game. Mm-hmm. I might pick it up just to kind of experience this in high definition. What are your thoughts on your initial thoughts on Metal Gear Solid 3 Snake Eater?
So I hadn't experienced this in full since the game first came out, way back in 2004, apparently, when I played through it and beat it. And I'd gone back to it a couple times, but I'd never gotten very far in the game to revisit on another playthrough. It just didn't have that replayability the same way that the earlier ones did. Like, I played 1 and 2 a lot more than this. So it's funny to me, because, like, remember how when we did 2, we went in with certain preconceptions about 2, and, upon, reviewing it again, we're just like, actually the story wasn't as convoluted, probably because we have hindsight of seeing how the rest of the series played out. And it actually has some, like, really prescient, topics in it that, turns out are really big deals today, and Kojima was kind of ahead of his time on that. With this one, I went into this as like, oh, like, this is definitely the best Metal Gear game from a story standpoint. And yet, since this is like the second viewing, all of the problems like stuck out like a sore thumb to me on this viewing. And I actually think that there's a lot of just bullshit in the game. There's so much stuff in this game and in this plot that absolutely positively do not need to be there. There's a lot of things and characters in this plot that really don't make any sense or weren't given enough time to shine. And I'm actually coming out of this like a little bit more down on Metal Gear Solid 3 than I used to be. I used to think that this was brilliant, and I feel like, when you're young and you see like a director whose movies you really glom onto, and you're like the biggest fucking fan of that director. And then as you get older and kind of see this, how the sausage is made a little bit, and realize like, oh, this guy's not actually as talented as I thought he was, and his films aren't quite as, hot, quite as good as I thought they were. I think that's kind of where I'm at with Kojima on this. And I think it's interesting. So a kind of a well-known piece of trivia about this game is that Kojima didn't want to direct it. Like, he wanted to move on to other projects and just kind of produce the game. And literally nobody at Konami on his team was willing to take the mantle from him. So he had to come back for this game. And in fact, would come back for several more Metal Gear games as well. Because, you know, Portable Ops and 1 and 2 came after this. And, of course, Metal Gear 4 and 5 came after this. But, yeah, like, I came out of this one actually kind of like, it might not actually be as good as everybody thinks it is. And we'll talk about a lot of those reasons as we talk about the game a little bit as we go through
it. Yeah, I'm very curious. I mean, I can think of some characters that don't need to, that don't really serve a purpose. They're called the Cobra Squad.
Well, there you go.
But you gotta have, you know, you gotta have bosses to fight in a video game, right? Like, but yeah, I'm interested if there are other characters that you think could just kind of be totally just like jettisoned from this particular story. It's like I said, I like this story because it feels like a 60s espionage movie, mm-hmm. where there's one too many like double, triple, there's like a person who is double crossing someone. It's like a quadruple cross in this movie.
Yeah.
Game. And that's a little bit much, right? Like, turns out I was working for China all along. Like, okay. But it was a fake. Like, okay. All right. And my biggest issue with this story is the pacing.
Well, that is arguably my biggest problem with it, because it is really a game of two halves, and like the first half of the game is so densely packed with action, and then the second half of the game spreads things out with way too much watching. Like it's really like, you know, it's almost as if they ran out of action pieces for the player to do in the game once they got past the first half of the game. Like, once they got you to Groznygrad, you literally spend half the game in that base and going through all the different story beats and stuff like that that are in there. Whereas in the first half of the game, you're moving from area to area, and there's all these boss battles. Like there's literally like boss battles coming at you incessantly in the first half of the game. Like, there's so many. And then in the second half of the game, there's just a lot of stopping and watching. Like, so I agree with you 100% that the pacing on this game is insane. This is also the first time that Kojima really did something that he would do with 4, which is, like, I call it, like, the NBA basketball gaming of a video game, where, like, the last hour of the game actually takes, like, 3.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, because it's like, oh, it's like 5 minutes left. Oh, foul this guy. Oh, foul this guy.
Yeah.
And we got to go
timeout, and all that stuff. And that's kind of how this game is, too, is it like for the last 2 hours of the game, the player is doing very little. And instead, they're sitting and watching an awful lot. And this would get doubly compounded with 4. Like, 4 is the entire act of the game is basically
4 is where I am at. That's where I get to where you are now.
Yeah.
Right? With 4. Because 4, I mean, we'll talk about 4 later. If you people really want us to talk about 4. But 4 is where the bloom is off the rose for me. Mm-hmm. Completely. Look, I think that the characters in this game, you know, aside from the Cobra Squad, who are just, they're weird gimmicks, and they're not really, this is like Christopher Nolan, right? Like, Christopher Nolan is like, everyone is like, oh, dude, just a Christopher Nolan movie, right? Like, it's hot shit, right? But if you actually look at a Christopher Nolan movie, it's they don't have characters, mm-hmm. right? Like, they don't, their characters are just kind of like ciphers. And some of them, one of them doesn't even have a name, right? In Tenet, the main character's name is the protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And this game has one, two, three, four, five whole ass characters who have no name. They are just the sorrow, the pain, the fear, the fury. Like, they don't, they're not really given a whole lot of backstory. Well, a little bit,
but not enough to
warrant, like, I'm a named character in this thing. Like, they're goons.
Especially when you compare it to the first two games in the series. Like, every single villain, like, boss character in the first two games of the series has, like you get a sense of their backstory. You get a sense of who they are, where they come from, what their motivations are. Is it delivered in a little bit of a ham-fisted fashion in two? Yes, probably. There's a lot of just like, hey, I'm getting ready to go fight this guy. Well, here's a shitload of exposition. Like that's kind of how it's delivered in two. I think in one it's better because the characters are usually delivering the exposition themselves, like as they talk to Snake, and so it feels a little bit more natural. But yeah, in this game, like, you're lucky to get a sentence or two of all of the Cobra Union, and the way the game portrays them collectively is that, like, oh my, if it wasn't for these guys, I don't know if the Allies would have won World War II. Like that's literally how they're presented in the game, is like this, like, essentially like a Watchmen-esque unit of fighters, like as the Watchmen were to Vietnam, the Cobras essentially are to World War II, and yet when you like Micah said, like, you come up across them and you fight them and all they are is a boss battle. Like you don't really learn anything about them other than like what their gimmick is, right? Like, you know, the pain can shoot bees at you and you know, and you know, bees coming out of his mouth, and that's weird. And like the fear is double jointed and has like poison tipped arrows that cause you to freak out. I guess he's supposed to be like some combination of the Predator and like the Scarecrow, essentially. I guess is what he is. The Fury went, like, I guess used a flamethrower in World War II, then went to space and then like bugged out and like now he just wants to burn the entire world, which is a bit odd to have like on this, you know, fighting unit, but okay, fine. The Sorrow's not even alive in this game. You encounter him through spirit medium. And then the end is just an old ass sniper who apparently has like photosynthesis powers.
Yeah. I mean, like, they're all gimmicks, right? They're all gimmicks. And the end is just like the meta gimmick, that the game kind of throws at you. It's cute, but like, even Snake, if you use one of the tricks to defeat the end, right? Mm-hmm. There's three ways you can defeat the end. One is the traditional fight, and then the other two are you can, I think, snipe him from afar before you're supposed to.
Yes.
And you can turn the game at the beginning of the fight, you can turn your game off and wait 8 days, or, you know, mess with your internal clock on your PlayStation and have the character die of old age because he's lived to be over 100 years old and he couldn't hold out 8 more days. but, and even if you take those latter two ways of defeating that boss, mm-hmm. even the character in the game laments that, like, oh, well, I didn't want to win like that. Yeah. So it's, yeah, they're like that whole. I get it.
But the whole Cobra Union is completely disposable.
Yeah.
Just completely disposable. Yeah. Like they are the weakest. I shouldn't say that because I think the Beauty and the Beast squad in 4 might be even. No, you still get more backstory on them. Like you at least like learn their origins when you defeat them. So yes, the Cobra Unit easily the most useless villains in the series that I can think of. Here's a hot take. I don't particularly think the boss is a very good character.
Really?
Yeah. So, and it's for two reasons. One, I think the way that she's portrayed, it's a very wooden performance. Like I don't think that, I just don't think the actress did a great job voicing the character. Also, from she was written really poorly because all the boss really exists to do in this game is she's a fulcrum of emotion for Snake. She's an emotional hurdle that he needs to overcome, and that's kind of really what the overarching plot of the game is, aside from the the actual plot of the game. But also, like, all of her dialogue is basically prophesizing of what Hideo Kojima's idea of soldiers in war are. And it's a lit, like, I'm someone who does also subscribe to, like, a lot of the military, especially considering that, a lot of poor folks and a lot of folks who have trouble, like the military tracks people who don't have other ways out of their, their class situations because they offer a guaranteed way out. And oftentimes, like, those people end up being kind of grist for, capitalist wars and view. And I think that that's kind of Kojima's point as well. But it's just so, it's simultaneously earnest from the soldier standpoint and also very cynical, overly cynical from the public standpoint. Like, the boss's whole shtick is, like, she's like, friends don't matter, family doesn't matter, really, like, allegiances and friendship, like, none of that matters. All that matters is allegiance to your country and following orders from your superior. Like, today's friend is, could be tomorrow's enemy, and that's just kind of the point that Kojima just keeps hammering home for some reason. And I guess he was fascinated at the fact that, the central plot of this game is kind of it's a Cold War era story. So it's like, hey, like, US, like, we were friends with the Soviet Union. They helped us win World War II. And then, like, immediately afterwards, like, we were on opposite sides of this war. And that, also went into the boss's personal life because her lover was on that side of the conflict and she had to murder him. And that, that was the sorrow and all that jazz. But it's just, I don't know, it's just so ham-fisted and just done in a way that I think's a better writer and a better, like, story creator could have just handled it more deftly. Like, the boss is a caricature to me this entire game.
Well, I hear what you're saying. Look, full disclosure, I'm a military mark. I have a soft spot for the military, mainly because of what you said, mm-hmm. That the military is people. I'm not a soft spot. I don't have a soft spot for the military. I have a soft spot for personnel.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like you said, sometimes it's literally the only way, or seemingly the only way, that people can kind of get out, right? I know people who have sent children to military school or whatever because, like, they don't know what to do with this problem child. And, I'm a mark for personnel, right? I'm not one of those, like, I'm a buy you a coffee, I'm a buy you your lunch or whatever, right? But I'll say thanks for your service or whatever, right? I think the boss is a very tragic character, because I think that I hear what you're saying about the actor's performance. I think it's all part of it, though. I think that this woman who, first of all, you go to the military, they kick the shit out of you and they destroy you so they can build you up. They want you to be that automaton. Mm-hmm. They want you to be that person, that weapon. You don't, that's why military personnel are, they have problems with their emotions. Because they don't know how to express themselves because they've literally had it beaten out of them, and I really find that kind of sad. I understand what she's like when she's like, there is only loyalty and loyalty to the mission, and because, like, that's what the military does. It beats the shit out of you. The one part where she's explaining, like, you know, where she gave birth on the battlefield. Like, giving birth is a very human thing. It's a thing that is that robots don't do, mm-hmm. and the military doesn't want that. They snatch the baby out from her, you know, her possible one last grasp of real humanity, and they stitch you up and they say go back out there and fight. Like, it's, I feel bad for that character, and I think I hear what you're saying about the performance, but I think that's part of it. But mm-hmm. It's not a great performance, but none of these performances are like blowing me away, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, even Hader, who I like a lot, as Snake, I don't think this was his strongest outing, let's say, from an emotional standpoint. I get what you're saying. Again, like, the character is just, I don't know. It's it's hard to see her as, like it's hard to see that humanity in her, even though she talks about it, because of just how the lines are delivered. I also didn't need like 15 minutes of exposition, like right before the fight with her.
Yeah,
it's just, we're leading up to this emotional climax of the game, and well, let me talk to you for a few minutes before we get down to it. that's always a little bit off. That's a little bit off. So yeah, so when your main group of villains is not exactly the strongest, you know, personalities, and I'll separate the boss aside for that. Really, my favorite boss fight in the game is the fight, and I use the term loosely, against the Sorrow, because that at least is a commentary, like, that fight is a commentary on how you chose to play the game, because when you fight the Sorrow, you're walking, like you're essentially, like, unconscious, but you're in, like, this spiritual realm, because that's where the Sorrow operates from. He's a ghost, essentially. It's like a spirit medium, because he's dead in real life. And as you're wading through this river, you're accosted by literally the people that you had killed in the game to that point. And of course, one of the tenets of Metal Gear is that it's a game you can play without killing anybody. So if you, as the player, are careless and play the game in a very deadly style, that part is actually really harrowing, because there's like essentially like a shitload of zombies flying at you, in order to, like, that you have to kind of get through. And the way that the fight ends is clever, because essentially, like, you get to the Sorrow's corpse at the end of this river and you touch it and you die. But you, it's essentially like you have to die to be reborn. And I guess symbolically, like, Naked Snake is dying, and that's actually the birth of Big Boss in a lot of ways. Cause, you know, at that point he was at his lowest, you know, lowest moment, where the mission seemed like it was a failure, and he lost a fucking eye. Thanks to Ocelot. So he was at rock bottom at that point. And so, like, you know, there's the figurative sense of him being reborn to finish the mission, essentially. So I thought that was cool. Everything else was really standard boss fare. You know, the fight against the Fury, I remember being a joke, pretty much. And really all of them were. Like, they were all easy. Because of the tools the game gives you. The end was probably the most difficult from a mechanic standpoint. And then, of course, the fight against the boss is interesting, just because it's like this emotional payoff, and you have to use the skills that, you know, she taught you to finish her off. But at the same time, it's just you know, punch, kicking her in this field of white flowers, essentially. The boss characters were rough in this one.
So yeah, the cutscene, the YouTube clip of all the videos that I saw of all the cutscenes that I saw, they did this thing where it's not just like cutscene. They tie the cutscenes together with actual gameplay, mm-hmm. to kind of get you from point A to point B. And they did that with some of the boss battles, right? So you could see how the game kind of mechanically is how you deal with these bosses. And all of them felt like hide and seek, right? Like the Fury is just hiding in, you have to find the Fury in flames. At the end, you have to find the Fury, or you have to find the end in the jungle. The Fear, you have to find them, you know, in the trees or whatever. The Pain was just, you know, dodge the bees, right?
It really was.
And, and like you said, the sorrow was a boss, but not the fight wasn't a traditional boss fight. So I hear you with like the actual bosses. I find it funny that Wikipedia talks about the Cobra unit. Here is exactly what the Wikipedia plot summary says about the Cobra unit, and bear with me, this might take a while. Snake eliminates the remaining Cobra members, the Fear, the End, and the Fury. That's it. That's it.
Yeah. Now, I guess this would be as good a time as any to talk about Volgan, who is in many ways the main antagonist of the game. He's just to me, he's kind of just a less interesting Liquid Snake. Like he's got that same sort of flamboyantish to him that Liquid Snake had. He's fine. Like his ability to generate electricity is interesting, and I think it's more interesting that he uses that in conjunction with like bullets, where like he'll like have bullets in between his fingers and he'll use his electricity to essentially like punch, you know, like gunshots into things essentially, which I think is a cool character quirk. Of course, it ends up being also his downfall.
Yeah, I was about to say, man, like that's my big thing. Like, I wasn't expecting like I was expecting a megalomaniac, and I got a megalomaniac. The biggest problem for me with Volgan is that he's got this like electrical powers, but he wears a bandolier of bullets across his vital organs. Like, that might not be the smartest thing to do. When you can, you know, blow those things up at will. But look, I thought he was fine. I thought he was goofy. I thought he was he's just a lunatic. And this game isn't about him, right? Like, this game is a weird like mother son story. This is like a weird Pat Benatar the game, right? Like, loves a battlefield and all that shit, right? But Volgan is not, you know, Volgan did what he was supposed to do. Yeah. He is not the most interesting character in this game. This next character is interesting, but I think he's interesting purely because of hindsight and what we see, what we know he will become. Mm-hmm. And that's Ocelot. It's kind of wild to see Ocelot as a very young man, super green.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because this character almost requires you'd have played the previous two games.
Yep, that's it.
Because if you don't, if you know him, you know, starting the game with an automatic, you know, and then Snake being like, man, you probably shouldn't use that. Like, like, that's not the type of gun that you need to use. And it's like, oh, that's how we started doing it. And you know, like his very like outlandish style, his method of combat, things like that. If you don't have those first two games of some knowledge of who the character is, I think a lot of what's fun about this portrayal of Ocelot is lost on you. Also, was it clear to you? And I picked this up more on the second viewing, was it clear to you that Ocelot is the boss's son?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I thought that was kind of, you know, I thought that was kind of obvious, right? Mm-hmm. Like when she's talking about, like, you know, her child taken from the battlefield and all that, and at one point Snake is like, well, this guy's really, really good. Like, he's really good, like boss levels of good. He's got the right stuff, almost as if he was born from a legendary soldier and, you know, a father who nobody knows about and is dead. Oh, hey, dead character in this game. Like, I thought it was obvious, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, she's also, and that's the thing. That's another thing about the boss that I could appreciate, right? Like, she is a very motherly character to these, like, misfits, to all of these, anyone. And I mean, I hope people don't take this the wrong way, but like, any woman who can get a bunch of dudes to follow them, especially like in the 60s, is fucking, I mean, she must be amazing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we can't even do that now for some reason. So yeah, I think yeah, that's just another reason why I like that character. The dichotomy of her being this person who basically had their humanity taken from them, literally and figuratively, is still like the motherly figure to a bunch of ragtag misfit, you know, dudes who wouldn't be where they are without her. Yeah, man, I actually really like that character. You're 100% right. Like, if you're not a fan of Revolver Ocelot, you're probably gonna be like, who's this punk?
Yeah.
Right?
And and again, like, you see, like, his plot in this game is, you see, like, the reverence that he has for this soldier and Snake kind of grow as the game goes along, which then leads into why, you know, he follows him in future installments of the series. So again, that's kind of why he's there. He probably gets more screen time than he needs from a plot standpoint. Like, I think he's just there as almost like a fan service-y sort of thing. It's also very funny to me how in the last third of the game, like, these characters who, you know, have all these, like, secret allegiances and have these secret machinations that are going on in the background, just kind of let that all drop, and Volgan doesn't really seem to care. So, like, either he's too stupid to realize what's going on around him, or, you know, he just, like, he's so singularly focused on destroying Snake that, like, he just doesn't give a shit about.
Well, that's what I think it is. I think it's, you know, it's a trope that, like, these megalomaniacs kind of lose their focus once they're challenged, right? Like, that's why you can derail Trump in a debate, right? Like, all you have to do is say, you got small hands. Like, no, I don't. No, I got big hands. They're very big. And you insinuated that something else was small. Well, I can tell you it's very big also. Like, so that's kind of a trope with megalomania. And I'm not upset by it. You know, Volgan kind of turns into a horror movie monster at the end of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't picture that character as smart to begin with. So his, you know, slight descent into lunacy it's not surprising to me.
Yeah.
Eva, let's talk about, Eva.
I like Eve a lot. Even though I think that some of her dialogue is a bit ham-fisted in how it's delivered. but I like that character existing. I think that see to me, she's almost like the anti-boss in a lot of ways. Like that character portrays a lot of agency. That even though she's just following orders as well at the end of the game from a unknown third party, it seems like she's really acting for herself as she goes through the game. Yeah. The other thing that that is funny about Eva, and I did not notice this the first time I played the game. I guess I just wasn't paying attention. Why is Solid Snake, and forgive me if I'm not using this term correctly, Solid Snake is a major herb in this game for some reason until the very end. And I'm not sure why.
Yeah, I don't know why either. I don't know why, and two, he could still be one, because like him grunting, it grossed me out. It was like the worst ASMR video ever.
But like she is not like there are several points in the game where Eva is not subtly coming on to Snake, and there's a million ways that Snake could like turn her down, like, you know, and still be cool. But instead, like, he just kind of looks like he doesn't understand what to do with a woman who's throwing herself at him. And again, that could be a limitation of the technology. That could just be a limitation of Kojima and the writer's ability to write those scenes and to understand, like, how a James Bond-esque character should behave in that situation. But it comes off as so painfully awkward.
Yeah, man, it was very odd seeing this woman literally throw herself at Snake, trying to do the classic honeypot, and he's just like, "Oh, but look at the stock on this gun."
that's the other thing that really fucking threw me off about that character. He has a very it's kind of like a socially awkward person who. Like, you bring up a topic that they're really versed in, and so they take it too far, like in trying to explain it to you. Like, that's him with literally, like, any gun that he happens upon in this game. Like, any gun that someone has or that someone gives him. Like buckle up for 2 minutes, because Naked Snake is about to give you the fucking tail of the tape of that weapon from stock to barrel. And
oh, man. So, you know, Snake has his cohort of support staff. There's Major Zero, who is the M of this story. Who, you know, suits, you know, that's his role. He does it fine.
He's your Colonel Campbell. What's funny is that that character has a much more interesting role to play in the story of Metal Gear, like as the timeline goes along. But you don't get any of that in this game. Like he's literally just like the Colonel Campbell, but without the, you know, the secret shit that Colonel Campbell has going on in the background in both of the first two games. Mm-hmm. So he is the support staff in general in this game is. Forgettable.
They're forgettable.
Yeah, like paramedic is just your standard, you know, game saving, like, here's how to treat your wounds guy, and then Sigind is a token black character who's there to tell you like what weapons do, essentially.
Yeah,
it's literally all he's there for,
and it's quite literally he's quite literally just the last, like, he's quite literally not needed.
Yeah,
right, like he's, you know, "Oh, Revolver Ocelot's gun has 6 shots, so he can only shoot you 6 times." Well, thanks, bro. I get it. There's also there's also an ammo counter in the corner. I think I got it. Yeah, very disappointing. You know, I love my black character.
Yeah, but, and again, like there could have easily been one that they could have shoehorned in and put in a much better role in this game. But Sigind is what you get, and.
Yeah,
not so great. So
I think that's it for major characters in this game. You know, so it turns out a brief summary of what's going on. There's at the beginning of the game, you have to rescue a guy who is taken back to. You have to rescue a Russian guy who defected to the U.S., but you have to go, but the Russians got him back, and you have to go rescue him, because he was a part of a...
I do have to interrupt. So this is the thing that the game does that I actually really like. I love stories like this that base themselves in real world events, but like retcon those events to make them fit inside of the story. So as the story goes, Sokolov is this weapons designer that's like the top Russian weapons designer, and he defects to the United States. And his family is over there, so they got him. And then they're like, but then the Cuban Missile Crisis happens, like the whole Bay of Pigs thing, and you know Kennedy and Khrushchev facing off against each other, and finally, you know, the U.S. you know pulls their nuclear weapons out of Turkey, and Russia pulls their nuclear weapons out of Cuba, and disaster is averted. Like that's a real thing that happened. Go check out, you know, the movie 13 Days or anything, because it's a really interesting time in American history. But the game says, oh, the U.S. pulling their missiles out of Turkey was just a ruse for the public. In this weapons scientist is so important that he was actually who we had to give back to Russia to curb this nuclear disaster from happening. So immediately, like, even though Sokolov is in many respects in this game a MacGuffin of sorts, like he's established as being super important, which I think is cool. Like, I think it's really neat that they use the Cuban Missile Crisis in this way. I think it's really neat that they have Lyndon Johnson there, like kind of giving the orders, and you meet him at the end of the game. Like, I just love the fact that they really, they did a good job, like, framing this inside of the actual Cold War conflict in the 60s, which I thought, like, even the point of the game where, like, Volgin is pressing against, like, he's pushing against, he's fighting within the Russian system against Khrushchev, and Khrushchev is like, oh, I actually need to help the Americans because my hold on power is weakening, which happened in real life. That's something that actually happened in real life, which again is cool that they kind of incorporated that into the mix.
Absolutely. It gives this game a certain, I don't want to say tactile, mm-hmm. but like a certain verisimilitude that the other games, you know, the other games are based in, like, very much based in science fiction, and this feels like science faction.
Mm-hmm.
So they got to rescue Sokolov. Because he could create a tank that can essentially throw nuclear bombs at people, right? Like, yes. it can move so fast that it acts as like a portable rail gun for missiles. And that's his mission at the beginning of the game. Everything falls apart because the boss, who was working with Snake, says, hey, I'm going to defect. Mm-hmm. So peace, right? Meanwhile, Volgin, that lunatic, shoots off a rocket,
a nuclear warhead.
Yeah, a warhead.
Yeah,
at Russia. So Russia's like, "What the fuck, U.S.?" And U.S. is like, "Yo, we didn't do it." And Russia's like, "All right, well, if you didn't do it, you have to prove it by stopping Volgin,
mm-hmm.
destroying the tank, the Shagahod. No Metal Gear's in this.
It's alluded to. Yes, it's alluded to.
A Metal Gear is hinted at. He's like, hey, imagine a bipedal tank, something that can trip and fall. Destroy the Shagahod and eliminate the boss because my government is going to think that you sent that spy to do this, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, basically the game then plays out. And at the end, somewhere in the middle, we find out that, they're after another MacGuffin. Mm-hmm. There are like three MacGuffins in this game. They're after another MacGuffin called the Philosopher's Legacy, which is basically, bank codes. Basically, mm-hmm. like they kind of want to, it's if you have that, you can have like $100 billion.
It's the what was the fucking what was the thing called in Mission Impossible Rogue Nation? The Syndicate? Like it's basically like the fucking Syndicate plan.
Essentially. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it. So you know, because it's all about money, right? At the end of the day, it's all about money.
And you come to find out that the boss, that's actually what she was sent in to do. She was sent in to recover the Philosopher's Legacy, because so Volgin somehow controls this massive fund of pooled wealth between the U.S., Soviet Union, and China from World War II, because somehow his dad was left in charge of it, and his dad, like, embezzled the money, like, embezzled $100 billion. This is $100 billion in, like, 1960 money.
Right.
Somehow embezzled and hid all this money, and then when he died, like, Volgin inherited it somehow, which is a bit convoluted,
don't think about it.
Don't think about it. It's fine.
Just know this guy's got $100 billion and everybody wants it, right? So look, it turns out that the boss essentially, she wasn't there to defect. She was supposed to, like you said, get the Philosopher's Legacy, bring it back. But because of Volgin's nuclear attack, the boss had to be seen as a traitor and had to be taken out. She had to be the fall guy.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted Snake, her pupil, her protege, to do it. So that the U.S. could, so that the U.S. could maintain its innocence.
Mm-hmm.
It's military porn, right? It's military melodrama. And look, I'm a sucker for that stuff, man. Yeah. I really do enjoy it. When all that is said and done, he goes to President Lyndon B. Johnson. And Lyndon B. Johnson does what I have to assume is something that Lyndon B. Johnson would actually do in real life.
Well, you're not just the boss; you're the boss.
I like how also that's an official title bestowed on him by the United States Commander in Chief. Major General, Jack Snake or anything like that. No, you are big boss. That's because you killed the boss and avenged her traitoring, so you are the big boss. And that's literally a title that, and again, the whole point of this game is a very convoluted way to explain the big boss origin story in the Metal Gear franchise. That's really what this game is about. It's about at the end of the day, it's about the Russia plot is cool, and it's the part of the story I like the most. But at the end of the day, it's a subplot to Snake overcoming his mentor, who, as you know, since she had the defect, who's to say she didn't pull some punches to make sure that Snake could overcome at the end of the day. And this is also where I think the whole crux of the story is to kind of explain how Big Boss ended up on the side of evil per se, because to see how the boss was treated, because he finds out about this from Eva, who the boss had confided in before her and Snake's climactic duel against each other. And so this is where he gained his cynicism for country.
Yeah, this is right. Exactly. This is why I enjoy this, because it's, these soldiers who, and I'm doing a lot of helping with this, Okay. I admit that. Right. But these soldiers who probably have come from nothing, because rich people don't let their children go into the military. They, when you are told by your country that we're going to break you down, but we're going to build you back up, and we're going to take care of you. And when you are told that your country, hey, I fucking died for you. She died for you. I lost an eye for you. You're going to tell me that, you're not going to take care of me? Fuck you. Mm-hmm. And I get that. And I feel, and I empathize with that. And, it makes me look at Big Boss in a different light, right? Like, he's not just now, he, you know, still kind of a terrorist, but he's but I have a little more understanding and sympathy for this character. Maybe not, you know, to the point where they need to create atrocities. but yeah, I look, it worked on me. It worked mm-hmm. on me. I'm a sucker for this
thing. Yeah. And that is the point though. Like they want you to see Big Boss as more of a human character and more of a sympathetic villain to your standpoint. And that would come full circle in 4. Like in 4, like you really get the payoff on that whole plot line that you didn't even realize was coming necessarily in Metal Gear 4. But yeah, it's fine. Like you said, it is very much military porn. I do want to talk about what I think is Kojima's most ambitious cinematography, let's call it, in this game. And that's when, you know, you strike the final blow on the boss and, like, this field of white flowers, like, the gunshot rings out and all of a sudden it just, like, it turns red. All these leaves, yeah, like, blow to the sky and shit yeah, like that. like that, that's him really going for it. Like, that's his Hollywood audition tape, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, the boss's heart was working overtime that day to pump out all that blood to make that entire field turn red. Also,
I think we're not meant to take that literally.
I know. But still. Also, you know, I get it, right? Like, we're dudes. I get it. But, like, you can let these women put clothes on, yo. Like, you don't have to be like, hey, here's my C-section scar that ran all the way up my chest for some reason.
Yeah, that was a little wild.
That was very weird.
You know? I'm forced to believe that Hideo Kojima knows nobody, no woman who has actually ever had to have a C-section.
Right, he's never seen a C-section scar before. That's what they do when you get an autopsy, bro.
Right, like we gotta open you up to your neck. Like, why? Like, the baby's down here.
it's very odd, yo. It's very odd. But like, we don't need to see these women like walking around just like, hey, here's a full uniform with my whole chest exposed, right? To be fair,
she's not walking around. The boss isn't walking around that way. Like, she shows it off.
Yeah, she shows it at the end,
just to demonstrate like her sacrifice, that yeah, like what she's had to give up.
Yeah, and I'm saying, zip it back up. That's it. Like, just zip it back up. We about to fight, yo.
Eva's functionally makes sense. Like, she's trying to seduce Snake at every turn, basically, to make sure that she can achieve her mission objective. She wants no loose ends.
Right, but once this dude starts breaking down like the history of like the Colt 45, it's just like, all right, yo, all right, this ain't gonna work. Yo. I'm dried right up. Zip, like, all right.
plus, that way, like, because he was foreshadowing for what is it, The Quiet later on in Metal Gear 5. Say, yeah, hey, like how about someone in a bra but even smaller? Like, let's right, go with that. So
I remember there was like pushback from that, and he was like, no, you got to play the game to figure out why she's dressed like that. There's a reason why she's dressed like that. It's because she's half a plant and uses photosynthesis or some shit. Like, nah, yo, get out of here, get out of here. That's dumb. That's dumb. Even for Metal Gear, that's dumb.
I was gonna say, so what do you think about the now that granted they don't have a lot of screen time in this game, and their machinations are happening behind the scene, but the philosophers as they're the precursors to the Patriots, essentially. Like, I do believe in the lore the Patriots do evolve out of this philosophers group.
Yes, I actually thought I read that somewhere, but. They do. Look, it's an Illuminati, right?
Yep.
Like, it's a classic It's a classic storytelling device of, you know, it's 12 people that actually run the world from all over the place. Like, I don't believe it, right? But I get why it's here. And I thought it was okay. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in this story that's kind of extra.
Mm-hmm. Like, well, it's just there to call back to other games or to set up for future games. Like, that, like, that's literally why right. half the stuff is in the game. So
right, I will accept Ocelot being in the game, right? But everything else, I just wish this was a more. If this story was a little tighter, right? Instead of 4 hours worth of cutscenes, maybe if it was like 2.5, and mm-hmm. you just don't have the Cobra unit at all. Like, I could just watch this. I could just watch this as a story.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's. I did enjoy it. I did enjoy it, especially compared to 4.
Yeah.
Yeah.
4. And I didn't even. 4 is a bit of a slog. And again, like, if you think that Kojima is being overly cynical in this movie, or in this game. Play MGS4, where it's just like, oh, like, pretty sure that all the whole world is going to devolve into nothing but private military corporations, and they're just going to fight right. each other, and that's the future. That's the future that we have. So I figure we use this part just to go over, like, a couple of our favorite scenes. I think for me, the big standout, first and foremost, is the opening credits, which is Kojima going full on. Like the proper opening credits, the opening titles, going full on Bond homage, with not only the Snake Eater theme, but with the Bond-esque visual accompaniment as well, which is fucking fantastic.
Darkness and silence through the night. What a thrill. I'm searching and I'll melt into you. What a fear in my heart. But you're so supreme. I give my
Yeah, I part of that is what kind of made me. I really like it. It's stylized in that, like, James Bond esque way. It's not. I mean, it's not bad. Like, I actually dig it. Like, there's. I wish there was more theme to it of, like, snakes eating themselves or something like that. Mm-hmm. But we do get a lot of, like, snake imagery and you know, it kind of and the song, look, as ridiculous as some of the lyrics are, what's this woman's name, Cynthia something, she is belting this song out, man.
Well, this song doesn't work unless you play it straight, you know what I mean? Like the lyrics yeah. are there to intentionally be funny, and to kind of make this a bit of a send up, but you have to, for it to work, you have to play it straight. Like, you can't wink and nod at the audience. Like, there has to be lyrics, like, you know, some days you'll die on a tree frog in there.
And you know what? But, like, people love it. Like, right. people love it. And, like you said, because she's giving it her all. So yeah, I dig it.
And again, like, it even does the Bondian thing where the lyrics allude to the plot of the game. Like, literally the chorus is, "I give my life not for honor but for you." Like, it's literally talking about, you know, sort of how Snake feels about the boss, and really what ends up, what, you know, what the boss ends up doing for Snake at the end of the game. So
yeah. Yeah, I dig it.
The first Ocelot scene, like the first, like the confrontation during the first extraction mission, when Ocelot's gun jams because he's trying to be a show off, and then Snake like overwhelms him, but instead of killing him, or instead of, you know, being the shit out of him, he just embarrasses him. He's like, you know, like, "Hey, like, you caused that to happen yourself. Like, and by the way, like, you, like, the way you hold your gun, you should probably use a revolver. Like, I don't know why you're using an automatic." And then that comes back around in their next confrontation, because like Ocelot, you know, fires off a couple shots, and then like Snake tells him, like, "Oh, you don't have what it takes to beat me." And Ocelot tries to shoot him with the revolver, and nothing happens. And it's because Snake counted like hell, like, you know, the revolver only has 6 shots. Like, you're used to having 8 shots in your gun. Yeah. Like, you only have 6. So like I knew you were empty because I was counting.
Yeah, I like the that's why I like this character being in here. But like you said, like, I part of the reason I like this character being in here is because I know who he turns into.
Mm-hmm.
And why he follows, and it's interesting to see why he follows the big boss. Yeah, there's no one particular standout scene that I'm like, "Oh, this is amazing," right? Like, this isn't like that. It doesn't have a scene that's like the reveal of a Metal Gear, you know what mm-hmm. I mean?
The reveal of the Shagohod didn't do it for you?
No, not really. You know, as much as I thought it would be like, "Oh, here's the," you know, I'm very disappointed with the Cobra unit. Like,
yeah,
like, I'm looking at some of the footage now, and a lot of it is just like, "I'm the Fury and I'm pissed off," right? And then let's fight. Like, it's not. And usually those are like the lead up to a fight, the anticipation of like, "Oh shit, like, this is about to happen. Mm-hmm. This is about to happen right now. Like, we doing this, right?" And there are no like memorable boss fights, right? Like, I can remember the Sniper Wolf boss fight, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's, yeah, everybody remembers the Psycho Mantis one, but yo, the Sniper Wolf one was dope. I remember like the moments leading up to Vulcan Raven. Like, it's, yeah, these, yeah, I'm really disappointed in the Cobra unit, but
yeah. We do have to talk about the fact that, so there's this other colonel in the game. I can't remember his name, but he has like a Raiden face, and you have like the Raiden mask in the entire game. You don't know why. And of course, infamously, apparently having some sort of relationship with Volgan, because as you're disguised as this colonel, when you're trying to break Sokolov out of the Groznygrad facility, Vulcan like comes up to you, and I guess because he suspects you might not be who you say you are, he grabs Snake by the balls and immediately realizes that those aren't the same testicles I'm accustomed to fondling on a regular basis.
I think I don't even think he was like, "You're not, you don't seem like who you think you are." I think he just like, "Hey, what's up? Bam, you want some of this? Like, this is mine. Come on, let's go." Like, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Something ain't right here.
But then he gets pissed off because when they're torturing Snake later, like, he even says like, "Oh, this is for hurting Ivan." Like he punishes Snake for, you know, locking up his significant other in a locker somewhere after stripping him naked and knocking him out. I do kind of like the scenes with Ocelot where he's being a petulant baby, where he's essentially playing like Russian roulette while juggling 3 revolvers. just to fuck with somebody as like a torture technique. And I also like how everyone around him is just like, fucking knock that shit off. Like, what the fuck are you doing, you asshole? And that's how Snake loses the eye, because he's doing that to Eva, who's you know, undercover as a spy. And he basically knocks, tries to kick the guns from Ocelot's hands, and one of them discharges, and that's how he loses his eye, right before the boss was instructed to remove Snake's eyes as a form of as a loyalty move for Vulgan.
Yeah, I've never been shot in the eye, but I'd have to imagine that there'd be a lot more damage.
Not just patching that one up and moving on.
I feel like they could have blocked that a little bit, where he's being a dickhead. The boss had at one point the knife right up at his eye. And, you know, Ocelot could have been being a dickhead. Someone could have startled him, and he could have fucked up. And then, you know, I don't know. I feel like they could have did that a little better than taking a bullet to the eyeball. at like close proximity too, man.
Which must have been like a glancing wound anyway, because otherwise it would have done a lot more damage.
right. Like, it's... so... But, you know, it is what it is. It's better than the way Nick Fury lost his eye in those MCU movies.
Okay. I mean, there's a lot of shaking off of pretty severe wounds. I mean, the entire game is you, like, breaking limbs and just, like, patching it up in a menu and then going on as if nothing happened. Like, literally Snake is embarking on... the second mission, literally in game time, a week after the first mission, where he literally got a broken arm, courtesy of the boss. So you do have to suspend your disbelief. There's also the part where Eva was thrown from the motorcycle while they were escaping, and literally has like a fucking tree branch poking up through her abdomen. And Snake's just like, just rub some dirt on it and shake it off. Like, we gotta go.
How's it look?
Pretty bad.
Like, all right then.
It's like, I like how you just diagnose, like, oh, like, it doesn't look like it hit anything vital. I'm like, bro, like, her liver is there. Like, that's not good. I can't imagine that's gonna go well. But you're right. Like, I mean, to your point, like, there's not a whole lot of standout scenes, because all of the scenes that are really standout are too talky-talky. Like for a series that is known for being too talky-talky a lot of the time, like, this really dials it up to an nth degree, where every bit of exposition that you seem to encounter literally takes, like, 5 to 6 minutes.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with exposition, but you can't just be like, this is literally a scene. Vulgan has Snake, you know, captured at one point, and he's like, Snake's like, what's the philosopher's legacy, right? And he's like, well, since you're about to die, I'll tell you. And then he goes on for like 10 minutes talking about the backstory of the philosophers, and then what the legacy is, and then it's like it's a very clunky way. It's again a ham-fisted way of disseminating story, and that's my biggest problem with all of Kojima's games. That's my biggest problem with Japanese game design as a whole.
I don't think it's fair to throw that all on Japan, because there is a game series that actually does this especially well, and they're a Japanese studio, and that's all the Souls games. The Souls games are actually incredibly deep with lore, but you have to seek it out, because, like, it's on, like, item descriptions and stuff like that. Like, it doesn't throw it at you, and it doesn't force it on you. Like, it's there if you want it to be there.
Well, I feel like there's a difference between lore and story, right? Okay. Well, I guess that's to your point, right? Because, like, the backstory of the philosophers and the that's lore. Mm-hmm. But he's telling you this lore to get to the part where, hey, the philosopher's legacy is a bunch of cash.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's, and that's what we want to know. Like, and instead of just saying, oh, it's just a bunch of cash, you can read about it in this data log or whatever.
Yeah. Or you can have a codec conversation with,
right,
you know, with Eva. Right.
Like, and they need, like, to have those codec conversations during gameplay, yo. Like, I don't like having to sit there. Like, what's the point of the codec?
Mm-hmm.
If not, if he's just gonna sit there and just like, oh, so that's a hind D. Oh, okay. Like, you know, you're supposed to be on the move, man.
My favorite is when you do the codec conversation like during the boss fight, where you're just like ducked behind a thing. You're like, hold on a second, like I need to talk to my friend for 2 minutes here to figure out how to kill you. Just can we hit pause real quick, but while I get my strategy together. And again, like I think you're supposed to believe that like that conversation is happening while Snake is doing what he's doing, which is why I think the video that we watched does a good job of editing those things together. Because like I said, they do play those codec conversations over top of the gameplay that you're seeing unfold. But it, like when you're actually playing the game, obviously it does not unfold that way.
Yeah. But look. I like this story. Again, I'm kind of a sucker for this particular brand of military masturbation.
I mean, after all my criticisms, I would still say that this is probably like the number two from a story standpoint. I think one's probably better. I think one is tighter, but it still makes you. It still invests you in the characters more than this game did. You know, especially the Cobra unit, as we talked about. I do think that this story, even though it's a bit weaker than I originally thought, is still obviously much more better realized than 2's is. And I think 4 actually probably has the worst story of all of them, because that since that game is just the culmination of this saga, that is literally just like, you know, crazy thing happening after crazy thing happening. Like it's almost very like a breakneck pace that's hard to keep up with.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with you. I think 1 is the best story. I think you need 1 to appreciate 3, mm-hmm. right? Like it's you know, everybody's favorite Star Wars movie. You know, people of a certain age, their favorite Star Wars movie is Episode 5, but you need Episode 4 to appreciate Episode 5. And I feel like that's what this is in terms of narrative. But yeah, any other final thoughts on Snake Eater?
Not that I can think of, because again, like 4 is such a departure from what this like this game does occupy. It's kind of like the last of the classic Metal Gears, and it's funny in that way, because when the game first came out, it had kind of the same, like it basically had the same gameplay systems as 2, and then they would eventually re-release this as Metal Gear Subsistence, which actually changed the game to have the over-the-shoulder camera that was kind of more akin to what 4 had. And I'm pretty sure like the new version that they're coming out with, when they come out with Delta, is going to have that gameplay view as well. But in many ways, like this was the last of the OG Metal Gears before it shifted hard to 4, which feels very different, even though it's still that, you know, even though you're still essentially doing the same kind of stuff. It just feels different to play. So.
Yeah. I'm not looking forward to revisiting 4.
I remember 4 was a game where a lot of cool shit happened. It is a tough game to talk about the plot because there, like I said, there's just so many fucking things happening in that game. It almost requires like having Cliff Notes by you in order to keep up. And that's just throughout the game, much less, you know, the hour and a half long ending cutscene where they tie up loose ends, introduce new loose ends, and then tie up those loose ends over this fucking movie, this feature-length movie, apparently, basically.
Yeah, he's not lying, folks. I timed it. It is 90 minutes. The ending is 90 minutes. God damn it. Look, if you're listening to this, you are a premium member, and we thank you for it. Brad and I will try to get some more stuff up here on the premium feed for you guys.
Well, I can talk about stuff that Mike and I have talked about doing. So we're not sure how or why or when, but somehow a lot of our earlier James Bond episodes got lost to the ether, probably in the transition when we moved hosts a couple years back. So I know that there's a lot of older James Bonds that are not available in the feed, which kind of sucks because some of those, like the whole Connery and Honor Majesty's Secret Service were both great episodes. So we might end up redoing those at some point, especially also because it's been several years since we did them. So like we could kind of tackle them in the same kind of format where we're not just kind of stepping through the story blow by blow, but we're just kind of talking about like, you know, the characters and the plot and things we liked. I think that this here format works much better for this show, kind of than just stepping through the movies. And then, of course, once I get around to seeing Dead Reckoning, we will have a short review of that film before we do, I'm sure, what will be a much longer look at the movie once it comes out on streaming so that we can really, you know, analyze it.
Yep. Sounds like a plan. Yep. Thank you very much for listening, and we will see you next time.
See ya.